Yeah.
Did you more Star Trek than Star Wars?
Probably more Star... Well, I used to be more Star Wars than Star Trek, but I'm probably more Star Trek these days.
I'm more Star Trek.
Yeah.
Q is on Star Trek Picard.
Yeah, I was in season two of Picard.
Yeah, also named after a character on Star Trek.
Q.
Well, I like to think he's named after me. But yeah, however you want to do it. It's funny because I did a... my buddy was doing a Star Trek con, so I went and I sat down at the table and they made a sign that said the other Q.
Oh, that's funny.
So you guys have known each other for a long time, and I'm surprised that like that specific conversation has never come up at any point.
Oh, it has. We've forgotten half the things we've said. We're just two crabs in a bucket.
Are you just like interview marathon today, going from one place to another?
I wouldn't say marathon.
It's more of like a steady jog, not a full 26.2.
Like a 5K.
It's more like a 5K.
Yeah. Like a charity 5K that nobody's really in it for, like, the gusto, you know? That's kind of what it is.
To prepare us watching some interviews with largely with the group. And I was thinking about how each time you sit down for an interview, you probably have no idea what to expect as far as like how serious the interviewer is going to take it.
I am fascinated. You've said something already that we've never thought about or in 14 years of TV.
What's that?
You sat down to prepare for, like, I've never heard that. Like, I wonder, do people prepare to interview us?
I don't know why.
That blows my mind.
Yeah.
Here's my trick after having done this a very long time is that at very least you should listen to or watch an interview with the person so you know how, like, they respond to questions. But I'm curious because, like, you know, I'm sure that like a lot of them have like a fairly like jokey turn, but every once in a while you'll sit down and somebody will want to get like super serious probably.
What did you glean from your preparations? what takeaway did you have?
You seem like very genuine and like genuinely, like the two of you specifically, I was like, oh, these guys are smart.
These are
two smart guys.
You have done your research. Excellent.
Brian, I you know, with you specifically, I got the impression that you are well read, but maybe have some difficulty actually expressing that. Is that a fair assessment?
It's a speech impediment. I don't know why everybody's got to bring it up.
You are the best read out of all of us.
I read a lot. I read a lot.
Tell me what's wrong with me.
That was a compliment. I think. Well, I listen. Like, so, I watched the Dom Herrera interview.
Oh, wow!
From God, like 9 years ago now, and you were really you had your feet to the fire because of the use of the word tableau. So, it, like, the two of you kind of have the opposite.
Yeah, I was a big tableau guy.
He was dropping tableau left and right for, like, 6 months.
Do you know, once every 5 months, Dom Herrera calls me? But I'm always in the, like, I'll be in the pool.
Really?
And my phone rings from Dom Herrera. Or I'm, like, making love to my wife, and the phone rings from Dom Herrera. He knows. I will at some point.
Yeah, I love
that. I just make a lot of love. I never get to call him back.
When was the last time you talked to him?
Oh, I thought you were going to say, when was the last time you did love?
First question for a second, and then we'll do each question one at a time.
Sure.
So, first, last time you talked to him, and then last time you made love.
I'm text him right now.
It's been at least a year. Oh, he's on LA time. He's not going to. He's up at 7:50 in the morning?
Well, he doesn't have the answer right now.
We'll just call him then.
No.
All right.
No.
Last time I
spoke, he's like 75, so like old people get up early, right?
That's racist. Maybe about a year ago, the last time I spoke.
Yeah.
But a great guy.
Yeah,
and then the last time we made love, about a year ago. Same answer.
Called that at that exact moment. So the reason why you haven't spoken for a while is you've been going through a drought. But it was interesting, like specifically from that interview, because I felt like the two of you, you know, like had the opposite problems with specifically with the word tableau, that you were sort of going out of your way to use you regretted it the next day, it seemed like. You felt like an asshole for having used the word tableau in a casual conversation.
It was fun because then we all like, it's become a regular part of our, you were high on tableau.
Sal is high. We're all high on words.
I remember the time you dropped tableau on us where we all started laughing. We were in LA and we were driving to CAA at the time.
Yeah.
And you said something about Tableau. We were like, did you just say Tableau?
And I said it. And I owned it.
Yeah. And there was a few weeks where we were all on about Tableau, but now we use it.
We're all hot on certain. You go through phases, right?
Yeah.
Sal's been hot on the unmitigated gall phase for a long time.
Sal went through the how do we solve for this?
How do we solve for this? And what's the other one he uses all the time still to this day?
Get away from me. I don't care if you're a fan.
That's it.
But how do we solve for this is a little bit marketing speech. It's a little bit like we'll circle back to that.
Yeah, I don't know who taught it to Sal, but he started saying it out of nowhere. Yeah recently.
Was Tableau specifically, is that part of your television background?
No.
We've got time. We won't talk about this the entire time, but I want to get to the bottom of this.
I'm not sure what the question is, but Tableau is a common word. It's a word that can be used in daily conversation. I use it all the time.
Yeah, that doesn't mean it's common.
You know, doing the job that you were doing at the time, whether that influenced your vocabulary, because obviously you were now working on both sides of the camera.
I don't think I ever used it in the TV development days. You don't go into a pitch meeting and be like, so this is a Tableau, you know?
You got to dumb it down for people.
You got to dumb it down.
Yeah.
We're supposed to talk about the Radio City Music Hall show, which is... I was told specifically that we have to talk about the Radio City
Music Hall. We're a little shaken because we just survived an earthquake. I don't know if you heard about that.
Oh, yeah, McQueens.
Did you feel it?
I don't know if it's because I'm from California, but everyone was texting me about it. I was like, I just did not notice it at all. Yeah. You guys seem to have gotten through it pretty well.
It was terrifying. Like, things were falling off the walls and stuff like that. People were, like, tripping and stuff. It was kind of scary over here. We're in Manhattan right now.
Wait, are you being serious? Things were, like, literally...
Yeah, it was nuts. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. We got off the elevator, and, like, the elevator started hitting a little bit, and we got out, and then people were kind of running around with their heads...
dogs and cats living together.
Mass hysteria.
Fueling the pink slime underneath the city. It's wild because I remember the last time, because I've been here for like close to 20 years at this point. I remember the last time there was like a big enough earthquake to be notable. Like, I remember exactly where I was. It's that rare in New York City that it's triangulate that moment that it happened to you.
Yeah, it's like the Kennedy assassination. Yeah. You know where you are when he was killed. We weren't born yet, though.
We were not, but my father...
So you did know where you were, in a sense.
He was running alongside the motorcade.
Your father claimed he was...
My father met JFK on Fulton Street in Manhattan when he was a serviceman.
Oh, wow.
And JFK got out of... I mean, several weeks before he died, got out of his motorcade and shook serviceman's hands and shook my father's hand on Fulton Street. And my father, in his late last years of life... warped the story to being that he was running alongside the motorcade in Dallas.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a pretty common thing, that sort of conflation with the things that you went through and like in pop culture, it seems
I think so. And it makes me wonder, what are we going to conflate, or what tableaus will we create in our minds?
If you will. Probably something involving making love to Dom Herrera would be my guess.
I'm probably shortchanging people, but a lot of times it seems like it's a result of like having maybe not have had that many experiences that people would classify as notable. So you conflate them with the things that you've seen on television. But like, you've the last, you know, 15 plus years of your lives have been pretty remarkable from where I'm sitting.
Yeah, I think so. We got to do a lot of cool stuff with each other. Yeah.
A lot of cool stuff. Yeah. I wonder how we're going to warp that, you know?
What if you're lying in bed right now and this is all a memory?
It could. I arrived early this morning when we started press, and I had a half hour to kill, and I fell asleep in the car. I lay down flat, and I had – this could be part of that dream. Maybe I am still in the car on 6th Avenue.
You got to update your dreams if this is what you're dreaming about.
Sitting in a conference room on a podcast. Well,
yeah, like my dreams have like Samantha Fox from 1988 running around. Yeah,
so yours. It would be like this, but I'd be slightly more attractive.
I mean, my dream is pretty epic, though. I just caused an earthquake in New York, New Jersey. That's an epic dream, man.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
You stick with Samantha Fox. I'm shaking the world in my.
I'm okay with that trade off.
Okay.
At this point, after so many years, do you still have surreal moments?
Oh, yeah, all the time, man. It kind of like – it's funny because was putting together a package for a charity thing, and I was signing our action figures for them to auction off. Sure. And I was like, crazy. It was like, oh, wow, we have three action figures? Yep. They made Halloween costumes out of us? Like, yep. It was all weird stuff. It, you know what? It's cool, like, when you first hear about it, and then you kind of forget about it.
Yeah. Well, that's the way life is.
This is true.
Yeah.
This is true.
You sort of have to have those moments where you can sort of step back for a moment and realize how...
We do have moments like that. The moments for me, not to answer a question seriously, but I will, Madison Square Garden.
Yeah,
there's that moment. I took the subway from my apartment downtown, got out of the subway, and Madison Square Garden said, Impractical Jokers.
Yeah.
And I literally had tears streaming down my face. The first time we stepped on stage at Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah, that was big.
Was a huge moment. Yeah. I remember standing on stage, seeing the audience for the first time in the crowd.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, tears.
We were all, for 2 minutes, we couldn't talk. Yeah, yep. It was cool. Yep. Like the Ryman Theater in Nashville was great. Was a big one, yeah. Yeah, the Greek Theater. That was my favorite show we ever did.
I was just talking about that last night. Because Tim Robinson from I Think You Should Leave is playing the Greek.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's my favorite show we ever did. We had a great time.
Me too.
I mean, now Radio City being a hometown venue for you, there's probably like old Madison Square Garden, obviously, as well. But there's something like next level about that. Not just this huge historic place, but being in effectively your hometown.
Yeah. I mean, I saw those Rockettes when I was a kid there. You know what I mean?
Did you know the story the last time I was... Before we got on stage at Radio City, the last time I was in Radio City?
No.
Was like 20 years ago. I went as a kid, of course, see the Rockettes, the whole thing. But 20 years ago, maybe 1998, 99, I snuck into a David Copperfield show at Radio City and then hung around and, you know, skulked about... And got into his meet and greet, and there was a meet and greet of like 8 people.
How old were you?
I was in college. I was a junior, so 21, I guess, you're a junior, and snuck into the meet and greet and met him in the late 90s.
And now you have his number.
And now I have his number, and he won't answer my calls.
Yeah, well, that's because of us.
Do you have David Copperfield's number?
He does.
I do.
And then we took his phone one time and started calling him or texting him and pretending we were you.
Well, you tried to get me to leave him a voicemail, but he picked up the phone.
Oh, that was it.
Everyone froze. We didn't realize it was a cell phone number. I thought it was his office number. And then I prank called David Copperfield live on the radio.
Are you friendly with him? Were you able to explain the situation?
Not anymore. Not since...
okay.
No.
He knew who you were at the time and then has cut you off since the prank.
Yeah.
Did he give you free tickets to his show?
I got free tickets and then got a free meet and greet pass to his show in Vegas. So I have to this day never paid to see him perform.
Nice.
One was a total, they were both scams. Nice. One is a, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe that's actually the source of the friction between the two of you.
It could be.
Again, obviously, there's something about playing like a Madison Square Garden or Radio City. Do you feel like you need to sort of up it to the next level? Is there something that you need to bring to shows like that? When you're playing a venue that's that venerated or historic?
You want to make sure you have a good show.
Yeah.
For sure. We kind of always do what we do. We're doing something new with this tour where we're punishing Sal on stage, like live on stage, and we bring up someone from the audience we just spoil it, right?
Yeah, might as well.
Yeah, we put shock collars that we have Sal wear on the show sometimes. And we have him wear them on stage, and we bring someone up from the audience to control the buttons to shock him while he tries to tell a story about his Jaden Smith tattoo. So that just brings down the house every night. It's people like watching Sal suffer.
I get the sense that there's always has to be like this escalation that happens, but after this many years, like, is there a point that you get to where there's got to be a point where you can't cross, right?
I think the show will end one day when one of us just dies.
Kill each other somehow.
In the Impractical Jokers movie that came out about 20 minutes before COVID hit in theaters, I lose the movie and I had to fly outside of an airplane. And the only way they would insure the movie and let us film it is if we film that punishment on the final day. That way, if I died doing it, they could still release the movie.
Yeah.
There'd just be a little like shot of you at the beginning of the movie, just like an in memoriam. How did you guys get through COVID? How did that impact your shooting schedule?
Well, you know, it's hard to make a hidden camera show, you know, when you're not allowed to stand that near any people. So we were down for a little bit.
A few months, yeah.
And then when we came back, you know, they had all these rules about, like, shooting TV shows. And all of them were like, we can't make a hidden camera show with these rules that you guys are doing. But we figured it out. We basically built a studio in New Jersey. Remember that? That college campus? Yeah, you on. That college campus. And we took over this college campus and turned it into different looks and invited people there.
They had multiple buildings on campus and houses and things like that. And the campus was empty. So we were able to, for months, we shot almost exclusively there and did focus groups and all sorts of taste tests and everything you want. We did a psychic experiments, you know, because they had all the science lab. They had all these great set pieces, essentially. And people thought it was legit because they're going to a college campus and it was all Impractical Jokers.
It was a weird time to shoot because we never get that experience of going to the same place for work every day.
And it was 25 minutes from my house. Yeah, it was the best season ever.
It was good because everybody, Warner Brothers put out this rule that everybody that appears on one of their shows has to have been tested. And we were like, well, we can't shoot in Manhattan and have a person walking down the street. We don't know if they've been tested or not. So we had to create a situation where we could test them before they got in to see us.
Yeah. It worked out well. And then we created a show during that time called Dinner Party, Impractical Jokers Dinner Party.
My favorite thing we ever did.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Me too. I love that. It was like us having dinner on Zoom together. We recorded it, and put it on TV. When we couldn't shoot Jokers, and
we had a blast.
It was so much fun. The surprises were great.
We had Ed Harris on, right?
Ed Harris and Jeff Daniels.
We had Patty Jenkins came on. Uh-huh. We had Colin Jost. Yeah, we had tons of people on.
Yeah,
and I loved that show. That was us at our like most purest.
I would love to do it. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I would love to do it again.
Yeah, that's something I hadn't considered. It's something I talk to about musicians and writers a lot is the power of constraints, you know, working within a certain confines can actually make you more creative because you have to find creative ways through it. And it sounds like that was very similar to your experience during COVID.
Well, one of my favorite punishments in show history was because of COVID. We couldn't film in person with people, what have you. So we created this punishment idea where there was a bunch of kids in the classroom on Zoom. They were like 7-8-year-old kids that thought that they were zooming into the International Space Station and they were going to be talking to an astronaut. And we built this set piece in a warehouse of a capsule that looked like the space station, and I was rigged up to the capsule, and the whole capsule rotated. The camera was fixed, and the camera would rotate with me. So the kids thought I was hovering upside down, but I wasn't. The camera just rotated with me. So there was still gravity on Earth, and I'm showing them how things are done in space, like eating spaghetti or drinking milk, and it's falling upward instead of down. I'm just upside down on set. So much fun.
You were pranking children, though.
Basically, yeah.
I mean, that's got to be heartbreaking for them, right? So once they realize
that. Like their problem.
It does seem like their problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's not even the worst one we did with a kid, right? The worst one was the turtle eggs.
Oh, my God.
So they got this children's museum on Staten Island, and they go, just go in that room and just do whatever we told you. So I didn't know idea what was going on. I get in a room and there's all these kids in front of me and there's all these chicken eggs and they're going, slam the chicken eggs on your head.
We told the kids they were like endangered turtle eggs. And the turtles are about to hatch, right?
So I'm breaking these eggs and the kids are going, no, no, no. And I had no idea what they were screaming about. It was pretty funny.
At a certain point, you've been doing this for so long, you know, you are fairly recognizable at this point. That in and of itself must be a fairly major constraint for doing some of these things.
We get around it. I don't think any of us really look famous.
Yeah,
I think I look like a pharmacist more than anything. But we get around it. What you don't realize is that taken out of context, you only see one of us at a time. And we're out of context. We're like last week we were working at a Raising Cane's, the chicken restaurant in Brooklyn, right? And we've got hats on, we're the manager polo shirt. I have different glasses on. And you're in the middle of people's real lives deep in Brooklyn. Like we still get away with it to this day because of that, the very nature of the show, you know?
There must be a certain percentage, though, that just don't make it in because you are, in fact, recognized from time to time.
Well, it's not as much as you think. We never discuss them in detail, but we have methods that weed people out before they even get to us.
Yep.
you know, we, like you said, we've been doing this a long time, so we figured out a trick or two. But we never say what they are because we don't want people to be able to circumvent them.
Yeah.
Especially in the early days when you were still figuring out some of these tricks, was there anything that just – have you ever had to completely scrap a thing just because it just didn't work?
Yeah. Mimes.
Mimes. You, yeah, it was your punishment,
it
was, right?
No, it wasn't a punishment. It was my idea.
Oh.
And you guys didn't want to do it, and I pushed it through, and it was a total disaster. It was – I still think the bit could work.
I agree. We just – we got – you got screwed by the weather.
So we were dressed like mimes, and we had to go up to people in Central Park by Bethesda Fountain, and we had to get people to guess what we were miming, and the guys were behind us holding up the sign, so you had to mime real stupid stuff. Not a bad bit.
No. On paper, it sounds great.
We were dressed in all black head to toe with berets and mime make like pancake, and it was 104 degrees that day.
In Central Park.
It was – I mean, we
and
were dying.
Within 5 minutes of filming the guys and I, we were melting.
Our faces were melting. There was no way to shoot it, and Sal started complaining so much. Remember, he was so angry.
Did we finish the bit?
No, we gave up. We just were like, fuck it, let's get out of here.
Went to Red Lobster.
Yeah.
Pretty good, though. Only one really jumps to mind after that many years of doing the show.
Yeah, two. I think there's only two we've ever.
Yeah, there's one other that we had to scrap. Oh, no, there's another one, a third we had to scrap. My punishment in season one, where you guys had me go to a that biker bar and ride the mechanical bull.
Oh,
and I was dressed
yeah.
in like short shorts. It just looked like I was having too much fun, and I was. It was a blast.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
And then we never aired it.
Yeah.
That's something that I hadn't considered, that you appearing to enjoy the punishment would be enough reason to scrap it from the show.
Yeah. I was having an absolute blast.
Even when you're being put in a difficult situation, it's still a pretty amazing thing that you get to do this for a living, and then you've been able to do it for as long as you have.
Well, we had Bruce Campbell on, and I'm like the biggest Evil Dead fan in the world, and they had me basically reenact the plot of Evil Dead 2, what Bruce Campbell was directing me, and he made it horrible. Like, they just doused me in blood, put my face in a river, broke plates over my head, and it was really hard and miserable to do, but at the end of the day, I was like, oh, I love that this so much. Yeah, it was like
you
the
know,
best day
So Bruce Campbell, you know, comes on set. He's going to help us punish Q. My favorite thing he said the whole day. At the beginning of the day, I was like, Bruce, you know, we're huge fans. We grew up watching you. We love the Evil Dead movies.
Yeah,
I said, you know, you're here on the set of Impractical Jokers. Did you know the show before? Have you seen lots of it? He goes, never heard of the show. I was like, you've never heard of it? He goes, no. I said, but you're here on it today. Why'd you agree to do it? He goes, you guys paid me. I was like, all right, there you go.
Following Bruce Campbell's career as much as I have, like, that applies to, I think, a lot of the things that he's done over the years.
The crew loved him, man. When he left set, he rolled down the window and he looked at the director and he goes, "Say you later, jerk." And then he rolled up the window. And then that night, because we shot that on Staten Island, the crew came back to my house and we were all drinking beers. There were like 30 people in my house afterwards. And Bruce started texting me. He goes, "I'm watching the show for the first time." After he had shot it, "I'm watching the hotel for the first time. You guys are almost funny." And then he was just watching it. He watched like 4 hours and he kept texting. And I kept reading his texts out to the crew. And we were all like doing shots and stuff like that.
That's so funny.
He's the man. But that was a tough thing to shoot. But it was so much fun in retrospect.
It is that really rare occurrence when you meet a famous person and they're like exactly like you think they would be.
Yeah. He's one of them.
I know you get asked a lot about the jobs you had prior to doing this. You having been in television and you having been a firefighter. Was there ever a point when I know obviously at some point all four of you had to really drop it and go all in on this, but do you still have this like feeling deep down that at some point this might just go away and that you might have to go back to your previous life?
Well, I'm too old to be a fireman now. I'm coming up on what would have been my 20-year retirement next year.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Wow. No, I think we've done enough at this point that, like, we could probably, after the show ends, coast, I think, for the lives. We could just do cons or whatever. We got asked to be in movies and TV shows. I think once you've been around as long as we are, like, there's always going to be someone that has some interest.
Isn't it strange that, I mean, we've been on TV 14 years now, right? We started filming the show May of 2010.
Yeah, so 13,
right? And and it's always been year by year.
Yeah.
You in TV, you never have any job security. It's not like, oh, I'm a company man. I've been there, you know, 18 years. It's nothing like that. It's every year is the same kind of stress of, will we be on TV next year or the next year? You know what I mean? It's year by year by year.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's kept us, I guess, on our toes.
Kept us on our toes. Yeah. It's, I think once they guaranteed two seasons, that was it. Yeah.
It's wild to be the most popular show on a station and still feel like you're year to year.
Yeah, it's the, you know, we could depress your audience. It's a rough business.
No, but I mean, gosh, we have the, we're in the, my mother always said, you don't know your golden years until you're past them.
Yeah.
And I think about that all the time. We have been in our golden years for the past, you know, decade plus.
Yeah. You know?
But we don't know what's going to come next.
That's true. Well, I know. In 8 days.
He insists that an asteroid's going to hit Earth in 8 days.
I've been tracking it for years. I just haven't told anyone.
Did you predict the earthquake as well?
It could be connected. I'll let you know. We'll see. But you'll find out. And we'll see. When's
I was going to say, I've got to get this show up pretty quick now.
I would get it up in the next 8 days.
Well, because the next sign is the solar eclipse.
That it's not coincidence, my friend.
Yeah.
The solar eclipse is going to affect the gravitational pull on the asteroid that's coming through our solar system as we speak. It's going to skew it slightly so it hits the keyhole. Yeah.
He talks like this all the time since he was 14 years old.
He's been predicting that asteroids?
Yeah.
All right. That makes me feel slightly better that you've been.
But there. When the end does come, it's going to be a wonderful tableau.
Talking about being year to year and talking about the difficulty of the television business, I'm curious how, you know, you've signed a contract for a new channel, how that changes the math for what you do.
Nothing, not at all.
Oh, you mean that we start airing on TBS?
Yeah.
It's
a sister network. We're always related to them, so it's just kind of.
Yeah, and we had a show on TBS exclusively. Yep.
Misery Index.
For three seasons called Misery Index. So it's just family.
Yeah, you know? same, different circus, same clowns. You know what I mean?
We're the clowns.
Yeah. Tell me what that was.